they were out of lids at the gas station. I had to go behind the counter and get like a special lid.
They were out of lids?
They were out of lids. I was like shaking my fist in the air. Supply chain!
How am I going to drink this coffee without a flat billed cap with the Transformers logo on it?
Right.
I can't believe this place is out of lids. Lids like right. The store.
Yes.
You know, like where they, at the mall, you remember?
Yeah. Yeah. The only, and the airport, I guess, in Pittsburgh.
Why would you buy a hat at an airport?
I don't know, but they have a
lids. We have a hat emergency.
I need some tax-free lids.
Welcome to The Crunch, the only podcast that has 10 episodes backed up in the port of Los Angeles. It's your boy, Ethan.
And I'm Patrick.
We're talking about supply chain management. How has supply chain affected you, Patrick?
Other than the lids. I'm curious. How has supply chain affected me? Oh, my gosh. Because
I feel like everyone's yelling about it, but then when I think about it, it's like, well, I still got apples, you know? Like, right? I can still go to the store, pick up a bag of carrots. Like, I'm not...
Pick up a bushel or a peck or a bushel and a peck?
Yeah. A bushel and a peck.
You know, I mean,
that old song.
I don't know if supply chain is to blame for all the things that I haven't been able to find at the store, but I wasn't able to find chocolate coins at the store.
Really? You were looking. You were actively looking for chocolate coins.
Yes, because I'm the minister.
This is an interesting thing because there are some candies out there that I've never sought out.
Yeah.
And yet they always find their way to me.
Interesting.
An example is jelly beans. Like, I've never gone to the store and been like, everyone out of my way. Give me to the jelly bean aisle, you know?
And it better have its own dedicated aisle. Otherwise, this doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
But chocolate coins are in the party section, by the way.
And why? Are they not in the regular candy section?
No, next to party favors. Because no one just buys chocolate coins in the candy section. It's
that's
not
a
grocery.
That's the thing that upsets me about stores is when things don't go where they ought to go. So candy should be in the candy aisle. I don't care what it's related to.
Yeah.
There are some things.
What you're expressing is the fact that your brain doesn't think like an algorithm.
Yeah.
Yeah. So like the reason stores, I mean, I'm sure back in the day, chocolate coins were in the candy aisle, but
yeah, with the chocolate,
but Walmart has figured out that people who buy candy don't buy chocolate coins, and people that buy streamers are buying chocolate coins. They put the chocolate coins next to the streamers. So you go, oh, I should have chocolate coins for little Jimmy's birthday.
Yes. When I go to the store, let me know if you're like this. I stress Emma out when I go to the store. Because I don't... She's very, I would say, calculating in the most warm and gentle way possible. She goes into the store and she looks at the list and she says, what do I need? And then she goes to each section and then gets everything she needs in that section before moving on to the next section.
Oh yeah.
When I go to the store, it is a bit of a, kamikaze just blitz wherein I will have to return to the same aisle three times to get something cause I forget it.
Yeah.
But I do it just as fast.
Really?
Cause I don't
race.
Well, it's like a race. I don't like spending time in the store. So a lot of times I'll be like, all right, I need a couple of things. And the spices will be in the same aisle as the pasta. And I'll go down the aisle, I'll get the pasta, and I'll flip it around. I'll go over the other side and get the tortilla chips. And I realize, oh, crap, I need garlic powder. So I got to go back to the aisle with the pasta and get the garlic powder just because it's lower on the list. You know, like I just forget.
Oh, I see.
Like if it's not the item on the list currently, then it might as well not exist in my mind.
I see. We organize the list based on section of the store.
But then it goes back to the original thing. Then I put something like party coins on it and I have to go, like the section gets completely thrown out the window.
Well, I mean, we just divide it based on the two doors in Walmart, right? You have food and not food.
Food, yeah.
And not food. Well, I mean, chocolate coins are on the not
food. Food and bikes.
Food
and
and TVs. Yes. TVs are never on the list. But yeah, so I go to the food section. I go to the not food section first. And then we have, but the problem is that the section, the items on our shared Apple iPhone note.
Mm-hmm.
That we share for our grocery list, highly recommend. Yeah. Is produce, dairy, dry goods. And of course, dry goods is like everything.
Does dry goods include like, I need a pack of undershirts, like that goes into dry goods?
Yeah, right. Non-perishable items like socks.
non-perishable items, including but not limited to a new toaster. Like,
what? So yeah, and the other thing is, once we've checked off an item, it just goes to the bottom of the unchecked items. And so sometimes when I'm making a list, I just scroll through the history of everything we've ever bought and I just uncheck things. And that's how I make my grocery list.
That's a good way to do it.
It is a pretty good way to do it. Because that way I'm not like, oh crap, I forgot we're out of olive oil and I need olive oil for this thing. Because that's the biggest thing, is like you forget cooking items that you're like, I was going to make spaghetti, but now I can't saute the onions in olive oil.
I love olive oil and I can never... I'm broken because I watched so many Gordon Ramsay videos like a year and a half ago. Now I can only say
just a touch.
Olive oil. I can't say it properly. So Emma's like, can you grab the olive oil? And I say, olive oil.
Olive oil.
She just ignores me now. But speaking of Gordon Ramsay and going back to Norm Macdonald, did you ever see that video of Norm and Gordon on Conan? And they did a cooking like segment. And Gordon is trying to teach both Conan and Norm how to do this dish at the same time. It is one of the funniest things I've ever seen in my life, because Gordon keeps swearing and Norm keeps swearing and Conan keeps yelling at them both because he's worried that the segment's not going to air because they keep swearing so much. It's it is one of the funniest things that I've ever seen in my life. Like I'd seen it a long time ago, and then I saw it again like when Norm died. And I watched it. I just cried. I cried laughing. I watched it like three times.
These are two people who have not had to worry about a standards and practices department for the last 15 years of their careers, respectively.
Yeah.
Oh man,
it's pretty funny. I would encourage you to watch it.
That's really funny. I gotta check that out. Every time you send me a Norm Macdonald video, I enjoy it immensely. Yes. I tried telling the moth joke to Phoebe, and she was like, "That's just kind of sad." And I was like, "No, but you don't get it. The light was on." She got hung up on like the broken family part. She was like, that poor moth.
Yes. Why does that moth have a cocked and loaded pistol on his bedside table? Man, he must be really sad. No, you don't understand. The light was on.
The light was on, baby. You need to see a podiatrist. Yeah. You need a psychiatrist. I have good news. I have good news and bad news.
Oh, dear.
The good news is I finally overcame a mental block in my academic pursuits this semester. My literature review topic was going to be a continuation from last semester on the diaconate, and I just couldn't get myself to care enough about it this time around. Dang. I was like, but I have to do it. The good news is I overcame that because I don't have to do it, right? Nobody's making me except for myself. The bad news is that the topic that I'm writing about is the church and state. Mm-hmm. And so we're probably going to be talking about that on podcasts soon.
That's fine with me.
That's what I'm going to be thinking about a lot.
I'm saddened that you've lost interest in your topic, but I'm encouraged that you have arrived to the same point on deacons that everybody else is at, is that generally I can't muster up enough energy to really care.
No. So like the paper that I wrote, I think I just said my piece, and I was like, this is my opinion on it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it hasn't changed.
Right.
And there's really no need to elaborate further.
Mm-hmm.
And if I send it to a friend who's like, I don't necessarily agree with you. I sent it to her and I was like, if you can come up with a really good argument, I'll reconsider my position. But until that point, or unless it gets published and someone comes up and is like, hey, you completely misunderstood X theologian, I'll be like, fine, I'll revisit it. But for now, I think I'm done. I read the New Polity magazine for fun. I was just like chilling. I was like, man, I should really be reading about the diaconate. And I was like, well, just why read about something that you don't care about right now? You know?
Dang, that's such a good point.
You know, and
yeah.
Because the topic was supposed to be the development of the diaconate, so I wanted to go in depth to like the historical development of the diaconate. But the problem is, then you have to read a bunch of people who are like, "Well, the original Greek meaning of the word diakonia," and I'm just like, I literally don't care.
Tell me
what
about
diakonia
history.
Means in Greek. Here's the thing, Ethan.
Tell me about
even if diakonia in Greek meant like circus clown, what would that mean for the usage of diakonia after Christ? Nothing
at all.
Right. Nothing. So why are so many people spending so much time parsing the etymology of the word diaconia?
Because they actually don't have anything to write about.
That's what it is.
Because they're just waiting for you to come out with your dissertation on the history of the diaconate before they can actually say anything of substance.
The word presbyter means elder. Do you think that priests should be old then? Is that your
seems
argument?
To be the case.
Yeah, well, there you go. and bishops mean overseer. So it's like obviously the root of a bishop, episcopate, means overseer. So it's like obviously a bishop, the heart of what a bishop is not his actor as not his overseeing of priests. A bishop is a bishop even without priests. And so like diaconia might mean waiter, but it doesn't mean that the deacon is supposed to be like the servant of the priest or the bishop. Someone wrote a whole book about it.
Really?
And I'm just like, I don't want to read
etymology?
That book.
Yeah. Well, don't read it.
Really
don't read it. No, don't.
I want to read about church and state, and I want to get really, really mad at Thomas Jefferson. That's what I want to do.
Dang. Speaking of Thomas Jefferson.
Sure.
A lot of people to be mad at in history.
Yeah.
A lot of people to be mad at.
It's, I mean, quite a few I could think of.
This is my unironic, this is my slight transition into the topic, but we don't have to go all the way there.
Yeah, yeah.
We're easing in. Like when you get into a hot tub for the first time, you're like, ooh.
Ooh.
And then you slide and you're like, ah. Hey, thank you for listening to this episode of The Crunch. Sorry to interrupt what I'm sure is a stimulating intellectual conversation, but I wanted to pause the episode real quick to let you hear from some of our sponsors. We will be back right after this. So I've been reading this book. I've been reading it a lot more. Characters of the Reformation by Belloc. I read it for like a couple hours yesterday. And it's
the Reformation, bunch of characters.
There are a lot of characters.
A lot of characters. I
just found myself every time I read a chapter, just getting more and more mad. I was like, he did what?
Oh my gosh. He took what from the monks?
He took what?
Those poor little nuns.
Here's especially about that period of time. I don't know what your AP European history education was like, but mine generally was, we watched this video about Henry VIII that was a spoof of an ABBA song. Do you know the one I'm talking about?
No.
It's, well, their song, Money, Money, Money by ABBA. You ever heard of that one?
Yeah.
Henry, Henry, Henry had so many wives that had to die. Henry, Henry, Henry had so many, only one survived. Six wives in all the things they could do if they hadn't married Henry. That was their downfall.
I when you were saying that, I was reminded of, I'm sorry, you weren't done.
No, but I can stop for now. Otherwise, I'll just keep going. Go ahead. Yeah.
You mentioned getting really, really mad at history, at people in history. And it reminded me of an article that was written by Mark Barnes, who's this blogger that I know about. And he mentioned, it's an article he wrote on the desire to shoot a drone.
Okay.
And it's a little picture of an Amazon Prime robot. And, I think they make them look cute, so you don't want to kick them. But
sure, but we got to.
He was talking about how he's like I'm sitting at a coffee shop in Pittsburgh, and I just watched a drone walk by, and a guy like pretended to kick it. it's funny because he mentions this. He's like, this guy that I know is an incredible moral man, and he's great, and he's wise, and he's good. They squat down on their haunches to talk to children. They tend to wake up early, though they don't go out of your way to tell you about that. And they are more amused by our evil world than morbidly offended, prone to offer a joke rather than a curse as a remedy. And I'm like, man, I wish. But for now, the podcast, I get mad.
Why is this? What was this? Oh, you're just saying like, we ought to be humored at the history instead of angered by it.
He says they're more amused by the world's evils than like angered by it. Yeah,
that might be a more interesting topic than what I was gonna say.
I was thinking about that as a topic, but
no, I think No, I think that's good.
I don't think we have enough wisdom on that because no, I just get...
Well, we can talk about how we desire to have more wisdom about it. Because here's the rub, okay? This is what I'm trying to get to. Then we can circle back to your quote from the thing. I'm reading this book. I'm getting mad, right?
Sure.
All we learned about in AP European history was King Henry VIII had a wife, needed an heir. First wife, no heir. You know, only a daughter. Second wife, no heir, only a daughter. Third wife, no heir. I don't know if she had a daughter. Couple, and then the last one, wham, we finally got little Edward. Hooray, little Edward, finally born. And the whole English Reformation thing is all cast in this light of this dude wanted to be married, and the Pope wouldn't let him do what he wanted, and so pew, we're gone. We're out of here.
Yeah, and I remember that being cast as like a, man, wasn't the Pope mean?
How dare he not grant this lustful
this despot
a divorce?
And like, and then by, and yeah, I totally remember this. It was like, yeah, the Pope just wouldn't relent, and it's his fault all those women died. And I'm like, yeah, no, it's not.
Exactly.
It's the guy who killed him.
Yes. Yeah, which is just crazy. And that's like kind of
you
all
know,
we
if
were...
you declare yourself the leader of your own religion, you can make it so that divorce is legal. That's the thing. But right. He didn't. He was like, yeah, divorce is legal. Also, I'm going to kill him.
Mm-hmm.
That's a whammy. That's a double whammy.
Yeah. I'm going to get so bored with them that I'm going to eliminate them because I still have this strange notion of marriage between one man and one woman. Although I don't have to because I declared myself the supreme ruler of church and state in my country. So I can just declare it to not be. So, but there's interesting.
I didn't say it. I declared it.
Right. So I'm mad about that. Right. And I'm mad about Thomas Cromwell, you know, taking this kind of split Thomas Cranmer and Thomas Cromwell, taking this opportunity where they're encouraging him to get a divorce, and Anne Boleyn is taking advantage of Henry, and she's kind of just like a power grabbing woman and a social ladder climber, if you will. And Thomas Cranmer, a lot of people don't know this. Thomas Cranmer was Anne Boleyn's like chaplain, like her family chaplain. So they were kind of working together to get around Henry VIII, and Thomas Cranmer became the first Protestant Archbishop of Canterbury, which is
I remember this
right, which is kind of the most powerful bishopric in England at the time, and so she's maneuvering so she can marry the Queen. He's maneuvering so that he can become this great
big bishop boy, yeah,
big bishop, because he actively hated the Mass and the, you know, the Eucharist and all of those things, and wanted to get rid of them because he had read the Reformers and agreed with them, or like he was in contact with Zwingli. And so he was the only one that kind of like actually just understood the like was a true reformer in the actual sense. And then Thomas Cromwell saw all this happening and said, this would be a great opportunity for me and all of my friends to get really rich. And that's basically what happened all across, like not just in England, but all across France and Germany and Spain and the Netherlands, like all of these places that were so traditionally Catholic. Essentially, it was like there were a couple of monarchs and a couple of nobles that really like held firm to the faith. But then there was always, wherever the Reformation happened, there was always a group of dudes who took this opportunity and all this social upheaval as an opportunity to just seize wealth that was not theirs. And that's the root of
which,
why...
which another word for what you described might be called stealing.
Stealing, yes. And that's why it was so difficult for the Counter-Reformation, quote unquote, to be successful, because there were a lot of Catholic people and Protestant people who were sympathetic with the Catholic cause that had become millionaires basically overnight. And if they were to agree that the Catholic Church was correct, then they would have to give those lands and the wealth back to the church.
Which is not, it's kind of a disincentivized move.
And so,
there.
Like, no one, like, that just was never, ever taught. And so it makes me frustrated that there were, first of all, that I was lied to. And second of all, that, like, I don't know if you ever have this, like when you're reading the Gospels or just anything about history and you see someone do something that you're like, dang it, that really ruined it. Like that messed it up in that moment. Like Judas, frick, come on. You could have done better. Or like the rich young man, you know, like this guy who was like, come on, you know, or you read these things about, you know, people persecuting Christians and Christians betraying, you know, the faith and all these things. And then you get later, like the more modern history, just seeing like one thing, I'm sure we'll talk about this when you research church and state stuff, but when King Henry VIII declared himself to be the ruler of all of church and all of state in England,
the head honcho, yeah,
the head honcho of everything, what he what he effectively was doing was saying
integralism, right? It was great.
Well, this is kind of connected with the other thing that I texted you about. He's basically saying, like, my country and my nation is independent of any kind of moral law other than what England decides moral law to be. And he kind of established this, and then his grandson or great grandson, James the First, really solidified it. And that's when we started hearing about the divine right of kings, quote unquote. And so that kind of took hold throughout Europe and led to lots of crazy things. So instead of it being like Christendom, where everyone was kind of subject to, even if they had disagreements, they were all subject to the same moral law. You have each individual nation deciding, you know, what's moral and what's immoral in their own realm. And there was no longer any room for the church to come in and say, hey, that's not right, right? That's like against all the things that we believe in. And it's interesting that Belloc talks about this. It's just kind of in a passing comment of just how in 1936, when he wrote that book, he said, there's no international governing moral body anymore. And this will probably lead to the end of civilization if things keep going as they are. And you know what started 3 years after that?
What was that?
World War II.
Oh, gosh.
Right. Like, and why did that occur? Because of intense nationalism and a lack of other countries telling Germany, hey, you're cut it out.
Stop.
Stop. Right. And then they didn't stop. And there was no way to keep them in check. And then what did we have to establish after World War II? The United Nations, and hence,
well, right. The League of Nations. No,
the League of Nations was after World War One,
and then I thought NATO was about World War II.
Maybe. When was the United Nations founded? That's an interesting.
I don't know.
I thought it was after World War. Maybe I'm wrong.
The World Wars. Well, I took a
1945. Yeah, it happened after.
Oh,
after World War II.
Cool. I took a test. Do you know Gallup's Clifton Strengths? You ever heard of this thing? Mm-mm. It's like an in-depth personality test. It's like there's 34 themes of talent, and you take this test that organizes your 34 themes in order of like what's the most prominent to what's the least prominent.
Okay.
It's pretty cool. One of the questions on the test was, I frequently think about the causes of world wars, and I was like, oh boy, yeah.
Yes.
I have a podcast where we bring it up pretty much every month at minimum.
At minimum.
And I was like, what a specific question, huh? But it's funny because like I was talking to Phoebe about this the other day. I was like, man, the amount of times as a teenager, I had to like answer for the Catholic Church in my world history mm-hmm. class when it came mm-hmm. to the Crusades and the Galilean controversy.
Yes.
When I could have just looked at my history teacher and been like, okay, liberalism has to account for two world wars and communism.
Yes.
That is worse.
It is worse.
That's worse.
So much worse.
And I just, it's this, and what's funny is that I was learning this narrative. I mean, I'm still not over how upset I am about like the historical narrative that I was given in high school versus the one that I kind of came to understand later in life. But what really bugs me is that during when I was learning that historical narrative, or it wasn't really a narrative, it was like I'm learning facts about history, because that's what history
mm-hmm.
was.
Mm-hmm.
And history is about like omitting certain facts and emphasizing others. De-emphasizing and emphasizing. And one thing that while I was learning the traditional historical Western and pretty much very anti-Catholic and somewhat pro-Protestant narrative, we were also hearing people say, well, history is written by the victors.
Mm-hmm.
And never once did I stop and think and be like, okay, how is this historical narrative being shaped by the ideological victors of our age? Like mm-hmm. it's very clear that the Catholic Church is not an ideological victor. And like I would have conversations with people and they'd be like, oh, but like the Catholic Church is like a victor, and so like they wrote a lot of our understanding of history.
No,
like, yeah, but like sure they may have in the past,
mm-hmm.
but it's not anymore.
Not
it's
in the last 500 years. The Pope used to be the guy who crowned emperors.
Right.
And now he is a little man who comes out on the porch and says, hello, everybody.
Hey, look at me. I'm a Pope.
You cannot pray in Latin anymore.
I'm from the other side of the world instead of Italy. Side,
but
man.
I still speak the Italiano, but also in Espanol.
There's The papal states used to exist.
Yeah.
They no longer exist.
I mean, if you just think about the...
Hey, you know what might not have happened if we had never lost the papal states? Italian fascism.
Italian fascism, German fascism.
Well, maybe German fascism. But if the Holy Roman Empire never fallen, there wouldn't have been a Germany.
Well, definitely German fascism. Because the only reason that Otto von Bismarck did what he did in the first place is because some French prime minister hired the King of Sweden to make war on Ferdinand II.
Why does nobody ever talk about Ferdinand II?
Nobody ever talks about how Ferdinand II was going to reunite all of Catholic mainland Europe because he was the emperor of the Germanic, I don't know what you call them, the Germanic kingdom. And
it was the Holy Roman Empire.
It was the Holy Roman Empire. He was in union with Spain. He was in union with, they were supposed to be in union with England, but then they weren't anymore because the old emperor's aunt was Henry's first wife, which is another thing that we don't talk about. Like there was a political motivation for the Protestants to get rid of Henry's first wife because she had connections with mainland Catholic Europe.
Yeah.
So, but he was going to do this. And then the French prime minister was like, man, you guys are getting a little too powerful, and like we're over here and we're Protestant, you're over there and you're some of France is Protestant, you know, a significant minority that are very rich people are Protestant because we stole all the lands. So I'm gonna hire the military genius Gustavus Adolphus to attack you, and the only reason that all of the Holy Roman Empire didn't get completely wiped out is because he got accidentally killed in battle. And so it's, and then the whole reason that Bismarck had to come in and do his thing later and try to reunite all of Germany is because the Protestants had attacked Germany in the first place. It would have been united under Christendom, you know, and so they didn't need to be. So Otto von Bismarck united it and then became Protestant, and then they lost it after World War I, and then that's trying to conquer, you know.
That's a great impression of Norm MacDonald's great impression of Hitler.
I know.
It's just
crazy.
I was reading an article about church and state, and it was talking about like the hypothetical situation of like states declaring a national religion. He was like, and the guy was like, well, it may work in traditionally Catholic, specifically in the Catholic sphere. And he's like, it may work in traditionally Catholic countries like Spain and Portugal, but it wouldn't work in other countries that aren't traditionally Catholic. I'm like, what do you mean? Traditionally, how far back? How far back are we going?
I mean,
if you want to go back like 1,000 years, everybody was Catholic. If you want to go back 3,000 years, no one was Catholic. So
yeah, like Asia, like China, Japan,
the Far East,
the Korean Peninsula, yeah, the Far East, and then like the indigenous places of America and Australia, like everybody was Catholic, you know, everybody. And so it's just kind of nuts. Like, imagine if we were able to put all of our missionary efforts into evangelizing the Far East instead of having to wage war with the Protestants who were stealing church lands. Like, okay, I'm not going to get into this anymore because it's very upsetting. But I want to go back to your original thing. Now that I've kind of laid out, like, here's all the things that I've been reading about and getting frustrated about, it's hard for me to just accept the hand that we've been dealt.
You know? It's kind of like, I don't want this. I want the thing that was supposed to happen.
Right. And I don't mean this in like, you know, we have to restore the traditional liturgy and that's why, like, that's not the solution to this
problem.
Vatican
II was going to happen whether the Protestants existed or not.
Yes.
Well, who knows, but.
And so I'm curious, other than, you know, I don't want to fall into the same category as, I don't know, because I feel like what I'm doing is just doing what a lot of other people do about other issues, particularly maybe like race, and just say, well, educate yourself. And when you educate yourself, then you'll understand and you won't have all these wrong opinions about things anymore. Like, I don't want people to just quote unquote,
Google is free.
I don't want you to educate yourself and then just know the wrong thing or know the correct thing from the wrong thing. And that will make me feel like I'm not trying to feel better, but personally, what should how do we look at this history and look at here's what Catholicism was, and we very much see what it is now. And yes, we have to go like that book that we just talked about a couple weeks ago, From Christendom to Apostolic Mission. We have to recognize that we're not in Christendom anymore. But I'm hesitant because it's do we have to admit that Christendom was like bad, you know, that we would be, we're certainly like worse off. Like we'd be worse off today if we had Christendom as opposed to what we have now. Like, I feel like sometimes we get guilted into thinking like, well, that was before and now is now. And so it's, this is how it has to be.
Yeah. You know? Like there's
you get
that,
kind of gaslighted.
Yeah, it's that like joke, that joke of like, oh, this is what the world would look like if Christianity had never existed. It's like as if Christianity was like this. The world was great, you know. We were, and then we had technological developments, and then, you know, nothing because Christianity, and then all of a sudden we were like, nope, we like science now, and now we're enlightened. It's crazy because like you think about the early Middle Ages. And they had like little to no farming technology. And then monks got together and they're like, our job is to pray and think about the ground. And then they were like, did you ever hear about like about crop cycling? And then all of a sudden, boom,
wham,
agriculture. And it's like, there's so much that Christianity gave the world just because like we had a better relationship with the world around us and grace was working and, you know, things were doing well. And of course, human brokenness and evil still made its way into Christendom. That's not,
yeah,
but it's like, unfortunately the unfortunate narrative, and it's so hard to break people out of this. So hard to like bring it up. Like how much are you blaming Christianity for human weakness? Like why are you ascribing human weakness, like, oh, the human weakness part of like why these Catholic kings were awful. Mm-hmm. Why are you ascribing that to Christianity and not human weakness? You know, we don't do the same thing to the law in the Old Testament. You know, the Old Testament writers didn't do that to the Judean kings who sucked. They were like, yeah, these guys were not good and holy people, and therefore they were bad, and they made the kingdom worse, and they did awful things. And it's like looking at the old kings and queens and being like, hey, they did bad things, they did good things, you know? And
do you think that we have like a Catholic inferiority complex wherein we feel the need to like we feel bad advocating for the return of a Christendom-esque system because it wasn't perfect, and we feel like we can only advocate for systems and people that are perfect because cancel culture, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, I think you bring up a good point, is that if you are to challenge the liberal view of how the world is supposed to be governed and the structure, you need to present a perfect alternative because liberalism is presented as perfection.
And so we're already like, when you propose any kind of different way of governance or interaction between church and state, you are already coming off of your position is already weakened compared to what the other side is presenting themselves as.
What you should do is you should judge based on the system. You should have the system put itself on trial, right? You should have the system of political thought put itself on trial. Okay.
Mm.
This king was not was bad. He started a bad crusade, okay, and he killed people so that he could get money. Great. His professed ideological system is Christianity. Is that consistent with Christianity? Nope. Okay, so he's acting outside of his professed belief system. Let's interrogate liberalism based on its own belief system. Liberalism believes in a marketplace of ideas. Great. Okay, but if you say, and I don't agree with this position, that you think that the church should govern the state. I don't agree with that. But if you were to say that, you would get absolutely lambasted. And like, that's wrong. That's evil. That could never work. But the Vatican City is that exact situation. So it's like, are you saying it can't even work in Vatican City? It's like,
because it's working right now.
It's working right now. They have a post office and no supply chain issues. I'm just kidding.
But have you seen their post office? And they have a couple bathrooms, and then there's that post office again. You know,
that's great. They have a bunch of nuns, and they have a grandpa, and it's Pope Francis.
Yes,
universal grandpa.
The universal grandpa is Benedict. Let's be honest.
You're so right. Pope Francis is universal great uncle Francis. Right?
He is kind of the great uncle.
We all love him, you know. Grandpa. But yeah. But
you're it's like grandpa. He's from out of town. He didn't grow up here. You know.
That's true. He's not from Europe.
Yeah, he's not from Europe. He wasn't on the scene, as it were, for as long as Benedict and JP2 were.
We need to straighten up America if we ever want an American Pope. We really got to, like...
I don't think we're going to see one while we're alive, unfortunately. And if we do, it's going to be someone like... I don't know. Some guy.
Some dude.
It's just some dude. Just some bureaucrat.
I don't know... I don't know if the American West is ready for an American Pope, because, like, think of all the think pieces. Think of all the New York Times op-eds.
Yeah. Ooh.
You know?
Yeah. I'm still kind of just stuck on this of, like, I'm kind of living in this what-if world.
Sure.
Which I think is fun to explore every now and again. Surely we aren't the only ones who have read about these things. This can't just be us.
Yeah.
So I'm just kind of curious, like, we should have a priest and or a bishop on at some point. Like, do you remember what, like, Catholicism for the longest time, for like 1,000 years, had this symbiotic relationship with the rest of society, mm-hmm. you know? And it wasn't, they weren't opposed, nor was it a separate thing that you had to create a niche for. It was all kind of, the market worked with the church, and the church worked with charity, and then charity worked with governance, and then governance worked back with the church. Like, all sectors of life were all integrated.
Supposedly. I'm not actually sure if that worked 100% of the time, but.
Well, I mean... What else would have happened? Like, I'm just trying to imagine.
That's true. It had to at least have been, you know, sustainable. There had to have been at least some semblance of right. homeostasis.
Yeah, because it's
within the yeah.
Because it lasted for so long, right? Like, there's no way that it could have lasted for as long as it did if it didn't work. And there's no way it could have. You will know them by their fruits, right? The mass increase of wealth, the mass increase of. Technological advances, the increases in quality of life, it just like dignity of the way that people were treated, you know?
May I remind you, no slavery.
Again, let us be clear. Some guy tried to tell me that the church was responsible for Slavic slavery in the Middle Ages, and I was like, I don't know what you're talking about. But it doesn't sound correct.
It didn't sound correct. Also, let's say for a moment that that's true. Again, like I say, like working within someone's stated belief system, mm-hmm. let's see what Catholicism, okay, slavery not good within the Catholic belief system. Those people were acting in bad faith. They were not acting in good faith. Let's look at the liberal belief system. The liberal belief system was created, and then they were like, let's go take people. Maybe that might be inherent to the belief system. Yeah. I don't know.
Well, what I was saying.
That's probably not fair to say. I retract that. I don't want to get all.
I'll edit it out.
Weird. Thank you.
But I'm just curious that, like, do priests ever feel like they're, I don't know. I'm trying to think of a position in society that maybe is comparable. It'd be like maybe one day, probably in the next 50 years, when we completely outsource something like firefighting to robots. You know, like yeah, we don't, sure. and they still need a guy kind of like to sit at the station to, you know, accept the flowers that people bring or whatever. And he's like, he's a firefighter and he wanted to be a firefighter, but then he realizes that his job has been eclipsed by technology or some other thing. And when he's sitting there as a firefighter, he's got to be thinking, this is not like, I'm not doing the thing that my role was designed for, right? I am an administrator. Right now.
Yeah.
And so I think about that with like priests today. If you think about what was my role designed for? Like, what was the role of the priest designed for?
What I do.
Yeah. Like it's
yeah.
And then they're stuck in this administrative, you know, whatever. And I just can't help but ask or think or wonder, like, do priests ever feel that? Like where they just are sitting there and being like, this isn't, what I'm doing now is not what priests did for most of the time.
Well, there were priests in administrative roles back in the day. You know, someone had to watch Certainly. Over those ecclesial prisons. I had a friend. I was talking to a friend about what Christendom looked like, And I was talking to him about ecclesial prisons and how like parishes had, you could go to church jail.
Church jail.
And it blew. He was pissed. He was like, I can't believe that happened. And I was like, look, it sounds stupid and ridiculous to us. Okay. But what's detention? It's school jail.
School jail.
Okay. What's time off without pay? That's work jail. Okay. Everybody has their own systems of punishment and reward.
What's going to the DMV to get your tag renewed? It's car jail.
Car jail.
Car jail.
Getting your car about a car
what's,
jail.
What is spending some time in the clink because you were speeding? That's also car jail.
Overcooked chicken, right to jail. Undercooked fish, right to jail. Overcooked under. Apparently back in the day with Christendom, there was a schedule of fees. So like if you violated church law, you would have to pay a fee to the mm-hmm. to the diocese or to the Pope. There might have been an archdiocese in there somewhere, but like if you said a mass outside of your diocesan boundary without permission, boom, fee. If you wanted to get an annulment, you had to pay a fee. If you wanted to get married, you had to pay a fee. And it was like that was how the church like paid for its mm-hmm. itself. And now like the idea of having to pay for an annulment, people would get upset. Yeah.
They would riot.
They would riot. Yeah. And it's funny because it's like why? But we had to pay fees to get married, didn't we, Ethan? You had to pay for the church and you had to pay for the wedding coordinator. And I was like, why did I have to pay to get married? But I don't have to get paid. I don't have to pay to say that I didn't get married. But then I realized people would just divorce and not get an annulment and it'd be sad. But yeah, it's just, we have to understand that, like, I think something that we have to understand, you and me, is that, never mind.
From
sorry,
Christendom to administrative mission.
I'm going to tell other people what they have to understand. Then I'm going to say what I have to understand. People have to understand is our historical view is one way. And the way other people viewed the world in the past is different. And if we were truly liberal, if we had a truly liberal mindset, we would allow them that. We would say, it's okay that you established ecclesial prisons and a system of fines and taxes for the church. It's okay that you did that because it was a different time. You know, mm-hmm. You know when people say it was a different time when people talk about 2006 and how they made a joke disparaging gay people? And they're like, it was a different time. Not a different time. That was 2006. 1587 was a different time.
Right. Imagine the jokes they made about gay people then.
I feel like they didn't make jokes. I mean, like, I don't know.
That's true. You're probably right.
They probably didn't.
Yeah.
But like, it's a different system. It's a different society. It's a different culture. I think what you and I have to understand, though, is that we can't just reintroduce.
Yeah.
We can't be like, oh, since that was Christendom and that's what Christendom looked like, we have to reintroduce ecclesial prisons if we want everyone to be Catholic again. Like that's putting the cart before the ecclesial horse, if you will.
Yes.
And it's just the whole point of the thing that attracted me to post-liberalism was this. It's not something that says we gotta go, it's like not Doc Brown running out of the woods going, we have to go back, Marty. You know, it's just like it's accepting the good that came from liberalism mm-hmm. and moving it into something that's more Catholic than it was. That's why it's post-liberalism and not something completely different like integralism.
Yes.
This is what my paper is about. It's about integralism, liberalism, and post-liberalism.
I'm so happy for you.
I'm really excited to write about it.
I'm thinking now that because for a lot of people, like when you talk about why did you convert to Catholicism from whatever you were before, a lot of people, the answer is, well, things like the Eucharist, things like, some people convert because of the beauty of the Marian devotion. Some people convert because they say, like, well, it was the intellectual tradition. And some people just say flat out, like, you know, it's hard to argue with 2,000 years of Christianity, right? Like in an unbroken succession, like apostolic succession for a lot of people is the thing that kind of keeps them anchored. It's like, well, a lot of things sucked, but I can trace this guy back to this guy, back to this guy, back to Jesus. And I'll be able to keep doing that. And that's a really big thing. And so what I'm thinking is, as we move forward into the future, and we're trying to evangelize and we're trying to speak with Protestants and speak with people who have the liberal worldview, I think it's just, we have to make sure that we're knowledgeable about like what truly went down, you know? And I feel like it's frustrating that we've all been kind of robbed of this. Because when you suggest to people and say, oh, well, this is what Christendom was like, their initial response is like, no way, that would never work. Because a lot of times we don't even fully understand it. Don't really, like, even on this podcast, right? It's exposing the things that we don't fully understand.
Yeah, because Christendom isn't one united, unique, 1,000-year-old tradition. Like the advent of, it's like Roman imperialism, which is different than British imperialism in the 1800s, is part of that. And then you have like this split Roman Empire is the polity, and then you have feudalism in there, and it's like all of these things are different ways to organize the secular realm. And so it's like we can't just say, because Christendom evolved,
mm-hmm.
so we need to understand that like what the future of Catholic polity looks like is also sure. going to evolve.
I think even just suggesting to people that yes, it is possible that faith and culture and the state can all be cohesive. Because I think so many people, the reason that they don't even consider faith is because they don't see it as cohesive with their two other gods, which are the culture and politics.
Yeah.
And so it's like, well, this god is the most demanding and the most non-cohesive with my other two gods. So I'm going to kick this one out and just be a dual theist. Just culture and politics, and that's all I need. And that's really where most people are today. And so if we understand better, how could this actually work? How does this make sense for just your average person? How does it make sense as you move up the chain of hierarchy of people who are in charge and not in charge? I don't really have like a clear, you know, everyone should read these books, and then when we all read these books, then we'll all know. But if the Catholics who desire to evangelize seriously take the time to learn, okay, what really has happened? And like, what is the, that's kind of what our exercise in all these things of liberalism and understanding history and understanding just the changes of ideas. I think that's why it's so important. It's why it's encouraged me to keep reading on my own, because I just want to know like what happened.
Yeah.
And I feel like most of us, we just don't know what happened. We're like, well, I know that I'm Catholic and I know that there's this unbroken succession, and that means that every other Protestant is wrong. And that's just not good enough for most people. Like, there is an argument to be made, like an evangelical argument from the basis of history. Like, you can make arguments for the existence of God based on history. Like, if you argue for the resurrection of Jesus from a historical perspective, that would prove that God exists, right? If you could prove it historically, you know? So, like, it's legitimate to point at history and say, well, it seems most fitting that Catholicism be the religion that mankind belongs to, because mankind most flourished under Catholicism, you know? And like, that's not a bad argument. We just need to learn it and be able to defend it.
Jeez, man, I'm just trying to think about how that would go over if I like, you know, sitting at a bar with someone and be like, hey, you know what? Mankind most flourished under Catholicism. We should make everyone be Catholic. I think, Catholicism is great. You texted me yesterday about the UN.
Uh-huh.
I want to read it in full because I thought it was an incredible text. Occasionally, Ethan will just send me these texts that I'm just like, oh crap, he's right. Yesterday, 8:17 p.m. during Lifeteam. Realizing that the UN is just a crappy version of the international moral authority that was held by the church until the Protestant Reformation. Bummer. And you're right. It's like, you want to talk about a United Nations? Let's talk about the Catholic Church, you know? Mm-hmm. This is what people don't get is like, well, this is what I don't get, is that we're so American-centered. We think that like church-state unity means the church controlling what America does. Think about how many nations there are in the United Nations. Does the United Nations control what every nation does? Kind of. But it's like...
More and more.
But like, I mean, could you imagine if every president was being controlled by the Pope, right? He has to get approval from the Pope for everything. Oh my gosh.
That would take so long.
That would take so long. Like, just presidents and prime ministers and like submitting legislation to the Pope and saying, hey, this is what, like, we basically have a church state relationship with the United Nations, I think.
That was exactly my point, is that this is why I was talking about it earlier, like after World War II, because we didn't have, this was Belloc's point back in 36. He was saying, right now we don't have any kind of international like legislative or moral body governing things the way that the church was. And he saw this as bad. He was like, this is going to go, everyone's getting more and more nationalistic. Everyone's getting more and more independent. There's no way to regulate excesses or defects in a nation.
And like, then World War II happened? Or this is
Then World War II happened, right?
Okay, yeah.
So we clearly see that he was correct. And then United
signs
Nations
of
are...
Hilaire, signs of the times, Belloc, man. Oof.
Right. And then you have the United Nations being founded in 45, and it just points to the recognition, albeit in a kind of an agnostic, atheistic way, by human beings saying, well, we got rid of the thing that was keeping us all united. So we need to recreate it in our own image, after our own likeness.
With five states holding veto power.
Yeah.
And
yeah, it's if you think about it, it's very, I mean, it's comparable, right? Because the Pope kind of has that, the speaking infallibly, right, on matters of faith and morals, and China, Russia, the United States, France, the United Kingdom, and France, all also kind of hold that power in like a weird secular way.
Because they're the most important, right?
and they always will be. So it's just, it's interesting to me that we have this desire in us for something that's bigger than a nation.
Yeah.
To help all of humanity achieve what is moral and good. And yet we see, like, when you create a false church, right, if you look at the UN and kind of all of the think tanks and organizations that it spawned, it's like, oh, well, that didn't really work. 'Cause it wasn't founded on anything other than post-World War II optimism.
Were you ever part of the Future Problem Solvers thing?
I don't know what that is.
So it was in elementary school. I was part of this thing called Future Problem Solvers, and it was like you would go to these little conventions, and it was like Odyssey of the Mind. You ever hear about that?
I don't know what that is.
This must be
a Florida thing.
Dude, no, it wasn't a Florida thing. So you would go to these, like, Odyssey of the Mind was like you had to, it was basically like creativity competition. A mental creativity competition, and Future Problem Solvers would give you this, like, it would give you this scenario of, okay, so in the future there's this problem and you have to come up with creative means of solving this problem, and you and your five team members would put together like a presentation to, like, how we're going to solve this problem. And like, looking back, I was like, oh my gosh, they were training us to be part of think tanks. That's insane. That's what think tanks do. And that's not a bad thing, but like, right? You think it is?
I mean, I don't trust a think tank, an unregulated think tank. Let's just say that. And most of them are unregulated. They're funded by Peter Thiel and George Soros. And it's like, all right, is this what we're doing now? We're just going to let really rich guys who don't believe in God do this?
Just pay money for people to come up with ideas. But it was an interesting situation. It was an interesting experiment, because it was like, it was also running through. I mean, it was also coming up with problems, like, oh, hey, someone establishes this new technology. What could go wrong? What can we do to prevent this new technology from ruining society, right? And I was like, man, if only people had done that with the internet and the iPhone and the Facebook and the YouTube. If only we had done this. But it's interesting, because that is kind of a function that the church provided, right? Like, with humanae vitae and contraception. Hey, contraception may cause these problems. And then, is right. I mean, imagine a think tank that was guided by the Holy Spirit.
It's called Vatican II.
Vatican II, yeah.
And Vatican I and Council of Trent.
Are you saying the ecumenical councils are think tanks, Ethan?
I'm saying the ecumenical councils could be compared to think tanks under certain conditions.
I think think tanks are just what we want. We want our own secular version of ecumenical councils.
I think closer to what a think tank is in the history of the church is the original university, because it wasn't tied to any particular location. It was just a group of people who are all studying truth together.
Yeah.
So.
That's interesting.
Yes, the church did found the university system, which is really a think tank.
I have been thinking about the UN for the past couple of weeks because I was listening to this podcast, a conspiracy theory podcast, and they went back in the day. They were listening to this guy, this conspiracy theorist, talk about the UN in 2003, and he was like, "Yep, that's the plan, folks. Hillary Clinton's going to become president, and Bill Clinton's going to become the Secretary General of the United Nations." And they were like laughing.
That'd be awful.
At the idea of they were like, "No way in hell would a former United States president get elected to be the Secretary General of the United Nations. That's crazy." Because, like, again, they have to pass veto power but I was thinking about it, and I was like, under these conditions, sure. Because they were saying part of the UN's veto committee is like, oh, the United States isn't the primary nation, but it's like, it's very clear that we view ourselves that way. And so it's like, it's not unimaginable that in the future, a former US president gets elected to the general secretary of the United Nations. You know, that's not crazy. I mean, the only thing stopping that right now is China and Russia, and that could change. You know, that's not, it could. And like, I mean, we're not here to like talk about that, but it's the funny thing is, I think this just solidifies my hypothesis that the United States of America really wants to be the Catholic Church.
And that's a whole other can of worms that you just opened up.
Sorry. Probably smelly now.
No. No.
I think we should bring Jacob Imam on the podcast from New Politics.
I feel like everyone would realize how stupid we both are if we brought Jacob Imam on the podcast.
I'll tell him. I'll be like, "Hey, Jacob, we want you to come on the podcast, and we want you to like actually talk about post-liberalism with our listeners so they know what's what." Oh, wait. Oh, my gosh. I can't believe I forgot to mention this last time.
Oh, dear.
We have a discount code with New Polity now.
Oh, sweet. Am I getting my magazine subscription in the mail?
You can get 10% off a subscription to New Polity journal of post-liberal thought. You can also get discounts on, they have video courses that are really good. I got access to the Dr. Logan Gage one on scientism. When I interviewed Dr. Logan Gage, a professor at Franciscan and part of New Polity, I interviewed him like way back in the day when I first heard about New Polity, and we talked about scientism, and his course on scientism is really good. You can get a discount on that. You can also get a discount on Mark Barnes's course on queer theory and the Catholic response to queer theory. It's very good.
I will say before Patrick keeps begging New Polity to let him be a part of their group,
I really want to be a part of it. Let me in.
just keep mentioning them enough, and then eventually they'll be like,
come on in. You're good. You're good. You're the you'll be the dumbest person in the room. Get your ass in here. Okay, it's not a URL. You have to use the discount code Crunch, I believe. Let me double check that. Discount code Crunch at checkout. To let them know we sent you.
Let them know we sent you. What I want to say before we move on to Dr. Ethan's Dating Corner is my desire is to continue learning more and more about these things. One day I would love to have a standalone narrative podcast wherein I start from some point that makes sense, probably William of Ockham, and walk through all of the things that led up to the Protestant Reformation, what actually happened in the Protestant Reformation, and then everything that occurred afterwards, because I feel like there's a lot of stuff that we miss out on and don't understand, and I don't understand it, and I've read maybe like two or three books to begin to understand it, but I need to read probably like 10 to 15 more to really start grasping it.
Two great books to start with. Have you read 10 books that screwed up the world?
No, I haven't. It's on my list, but it's so expensive when I look for it. Like, it's $40.
That's a book that I read when I was a sophomore, and it kind of kicked me off on this journey. I didn't realize
I would rather just read the 10 books rather than read a book about the 10 books.
No. You want to read a book about the 10 books.
You want to read
Coming of Age in American Samoa?
Yes.
Basically the 50 Shades of Grey of anthropology.
Yes.
You want to read Mein Kampf, Ethan?
Yes.
It's Mein Kampf is basically like, what if Twitter didn't have a character limit? That's what Mein Kampf is. That was a really good burn, wasn't it?
I'm sure it was really, yeah, someone's rolling in his grave.
That was pretty good.
Whoever wrote that one.
Yeah, take that one, Hitler.
I don't remember. Yeah, we really showed him.
Oh yeah, the coupon code is the crunch, by the way. Don't forget the.
What I'm saying is, what's the other book before I keep
going? Oh, Politicizing the Bible. I'm sure you've heard of that one.
I would just want to read books about history. I'm not really interested in books about history.
That Politicizing the Bible is about history, Ethan.
I don't want to read about the Bible.
All right, Ethan.
What the Bible think, is what all just think, a bunch of names and phone numbers.
What do you think they used to do Protestantism? They didn't use church documents. They used the Bible.
They used the Bible and...
A narrative history starting with William of Ockham to modern times is Politicizing the Bible.
All right, fine.
Yeah, you fine, mentioned it. So you should start there. And
fine.
When I do a literature review, like the last couple times I've done literature reviews, where I start with is people who have summarized readings, the and thing. Then I choose which ones to go deep on.
All right.
You can't just read everything. It's a
I want to
task.
Though.
Ethan, take it from me. Listen, I'm gonna take you under my wing right now, okay?
All
right,
please.
You're a young baby academic bird, okay?
I'm a little small. Don't little brain. Please help me feed me. Cheep, cheep, cheep.
I want you to take the Clifton strength so I can see whether how similar we are, because I feel like we're very similar on a lot of these.
What's your top one? We'll take it right now.
My top one is Learner. I bet you didn't see that one coming.
I think I took this back like freshman year of college, but I Clifton have not strengths? Taken it since. Yeah.
No way. This is huge. My top one is Learner, but my second is Restorative, which means I like bringing things back to their former glory. Isn't that interesting?
Do you have to pay for this?
You do.
Oh.
If you did it in college, you probably have a... If you sign in, you probably have your results. You might only have your top five.
Yeah, I have my top five somewhere.
Tell me your top five.
I think my top one was Woo, I'm pretty sure.
No way! That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
That's my number 10.
Woo stands for winning over others, yes. For those that don't know.
Yeah, winning others over, yeah.
And then I think my other ones were like Achiever, Responsibility, Communication, and like Activator. I think
yeah, you have a lot
five.
Of the... I think it's a lot of the influencing themes. Those are
yes.
Those are. My top three out of my five are strategic thinking themes, mm-hmm. And I have one executing and one influencing theme. I have no relationship building themes in my top 10.
Yeah,
isn't that weird?
It's a little weird.
I think that people are like when I told Phoebe that, she was surprised, and I was like, winning others over is something that I've developed over time. I think I'm just really good at winning people over. I'm not good at keeping them.
Yeah.
In a little corral, you know?
I have zero strategic strengths.
I think
as evidenced by the grocery store story at the very beginning of the podcast.
We have complementary themes, I think, and we have some that overlap. And I think I am very bad at keeping people together. I think that's I am not the glue that holds friend groups together. I am
the construction paper.
I'm not the construction paper. I am the guy that
pipe cleaner
tells everyone to. I'm the tip of the spear. I'm like, let's go jump off some bridges, and everyone's like, sweet,
nice.
I thought about it, and this is the best way to jump off a bridge. Let's all go do it.
Speaking of jumping off a bridge, how about we get into Dr. Ethan's dating corner?
I know it hurts. I'm sorry.
This is not your point.
All right, you came to the right place, you ding dong. It's called communication, baby.
Welcome to Dr. Ethan's Dating Corner, sponsored by Catholic Match. If you have a dating question, send it in to us by going to the link in the description, or you can go follow at Catholic Match. And this has already happened by the time this episode comes out, but I'm taking over Catholic Match's Instagram on Thursday, baby.
I'm so excited.
It's
going
to be really exciting. You know what I'm not going to do? I'm not going to sit in my house and be like, hey guys, I'm Patrick, and I'm taking over Catholic Match's Instagram today. That's what everyone else did. I looked at Instagram. I was like, this is so boring. This is boring.
You got to spice it up.
Now, someone was like in the airport listening and talking very quietly because they didn't want people to hear it. I'm like, you shouldn't have done this in the airport, buddy.
No, don't do it in the airport.
But I'm not. I'm going to be like, what's up, squad fam? Welcome to another awesome video. Before we get into it, smash that like button. Leave a thumbs up in the description below. Okay.
Please don't do that.
This first Dr. Ethan's Dating Corner, I might still do it, comes to us from Anonymous.
Nice.
The hacktivist group has sent us in a question. This one comes for this. The short summary is: how long is too long to date before marriage? My boyfriend, 27, and I, 26, have been together for 4.5 years. Funny enough, I've been a Crunch listener for almost as long. We met in college and were friends for 2 years before we started dating, so they've known each other for 6.5 years. Okay. We're super compatible, practicing Catholics, actively seeking to grow in faith, both artsy, same sense of humor, same musical taste, same political beliefs. Well, that's good if you listen to the Crunch. And I've got some weirdly niche political beliefs. Yeah, there you go. So it's been amazing to be with someone who truly gets me. All this is to say, I love him. I want to marry him. I think he'd make an incredible husband and father. Amazing. We've been talking about this relationship leading to marriage since we were 3 months in, but here we are, 4 years later, with no ring.
Oh dear.
Here's an issue. He has OCD and he's afraid of having kids. Not so much that he doesn't want them ever, just not right now. Being practicing Catholics, we're waiting for marriage and have no plans to contracept. To him, it's better for us to put off marriage until he feels mentally ready enough to be open to life. I don't really know if I should argue with that or how to argue with that or if I should, but I desperately want to marry him and I want to be a mother. Should I help him find ways to feel more prepared for marriage and parenthood, or is that an impossible task? Is it selfish of me to feel impatient after 4 years? I want to be patient and understanding, especially since I know his fears are rooted in his issues with mental illness, but I feel helpless. To make matters worse, everyone around me, friends and family, seem to be of the opinion that he's wasting my time, and I should give him an ultimatum. Oh my gosh, no happy marriage has ever started with an ultimatum.
With an ultimatum.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, I knew he was the one when
we dated for so long, and then he told me to either marry him or pack my bags, and then I decided.
And then I knew.
I knew. I knew that I had to stay.
I knew I was backed into a corner, and that's when I knew.
Right. At the moment when I felt pressured and I had no other options, that's when I decided to love him.
Is there
marriage
any way,
under duress?
Is there any way I can help my partner so that marriage and parenthood is not so daunting to him?
Yes. Yes, there are ways. Thank you for writing in. So proud of you for your faithful listening of the Crunch Catholic Podcast. I'm curious to hear what your niche political beliefs are, because the first thing that popped into my mind was, what, do you think the Supreme Court judges should stay on the bench even after they're dead? Because that'd be pretty niche. I'm going to issue this verdict from the grave.
One of my kids at youth ministry, I put up hip LED lights yesterday on the walls, and they make the whole place look kind of cool. Yeah. And they were rotating between colors, and one of the kids has, he's on the autism spectrum. He goes, "Wow, they're rotating through RGB." And I went, "Ruth Bader Ginsburg," and he didn't get it.
That's pretty funny. That's hilarious.
But he said RGB, okay. Not RBG. Anyway.
RGB. That's pretty funny. That's a good joke. That's a joke that I would make.
I knew. I thought about you while I made it.
Which is how we know it's a good joke. So let's Anonymous, thank you for writing in. I think there are ways to approach this without issuing ultimatums and also without backing down from the thing that you know is right. If you guys are compatible and you want to be married, you should not let something not let you get married, right? Having kids is not the thing that makes you holy. Being married is the thing that makes you. I mean, having kids does make you holy, but
in as much as you're getting grace through the sacrament of marriage.
Right. Yes. Right. Yes. 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 A lot of caveats there, but generally speaking, the vocation is to marriage. It's to be married to a husband or to a wife. There are legitimate grave reasons for not having kids. If you've been dating for 4.5 years, there's very few legitimate grave reasons to not be married, right? Like that is not a provision anywhere in anything. And so my initial thought is get married and figure it out, because then you'd be at least, you'd have more grace than you do now. So I'm always in the I'm in a pro grace, pro vocation position. My other thought is, I mean, I feel like counseling is something that he could start now to begin working through these things if he hasn't already. And so, I obviously want to be sympathetic because I don't have OCD or mental illnesses or that I'm aware of. It's very likely that I don't understand fully the extent to which he is struggling and suffering. But just having that conversation with him and just letting him know, hey, I'm not scared by your OCD. I don't think you're going to be a bad father because of it. I think your fears are valid and I think we can work through them together, but I don't think this is a reason for us not to seal a covenantal bond with one another, you know? And then if he's legitimate, like not ready to have kids, not ready to get pregnant. All right, that's a conversation that you two can have, and that's something that you can pray through when you are married.
May I introduce you to the Marquette method.
Exactly, right. And this is one of the reasons that NFP exists, right, is for these kinds of reasons.
Yes.
It'd be the exact same for people out there who are listening who are like, that's ridiculous, you should have kids, blah, 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 blah. Think about it the other way. Let's say it was the woman who had mental health issues because of some kind of traumatic experience, maybe a traumatic sexual experience in her life, and she was not ready to have kids. Would you force her to have a child because, you know, NFP is, you know, it's not a grave enough reason, like mental problem? Like, no, of course you wouldn't say that.
No, that'd be weird. It'd be a weird.
So I think a lot of times we
niche political opinion.
It would be. So I think we give men a hard time where it's just like, buck up, figure it out. But if he's legitimately struggling, help him get into counseling.
Yeah.
Because that's really, I mean, we can do as much as you can on your own, but sometimes you need a health professional. And I would say, yeah, try. Don't wait. Maybe not ultimatum, but maybe just sharing like, hey, I really want to spend the rest of my life with you, and I don't think this is a reason for us not to be married.
Yeah, what do you think, Pat? And next time everyone around you, quote unquote, gives you their opinion, say thank you for the free advice, but I prefer to pay for mine. Nice. I'll let you know. You know, like I'll let you know if I want more. Like, please don't burden me with your unsolicited advice. Everyone loves unsolicited advice. You know, just like have an honest conversation. I think what Ethan said of your OCD doesn't scare me. Get married. Get the graces of marriage. Make sure that you're in like a really good place to receive those graces. And marriage is good. And
marriage is good.
You know, NFP does work, by the way. Mm-hmm. It's good. It does the job.
Speaking of what we've been talking about this whole episode, if you think NFP doesn't work, it's because Protestants are lying to you. Sorry, but that's the truth.
You know what? You know what has a an 80% success rate? Contraception in its practical use. You know what has a 100% success rate? Not having sex when you're fertile. 100% success rate.
Bum, ba, dum, bum.
Yep. And remember, like I said, it is 100. Like I always say, it is 100% easier to not do something than it is to do something. Ever think about sinning? Just don't do it. It's actually easier to not do something.
Man, I've been struggling on that one.
Yeah, not doing sins.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it's easier to not do something than it is to do something.
You'd think, but then when you start doing
it, you're like, oh, I'm going to keep doing sins.
So good. Man. I'm having fun. All right. I think that's good. I don't want to belabor that because that's pretty serious. Contrary to a lot of the ones that we get, this is actually like a serious and important thing.
Yeah, you guys should like get, you guys should get married, man.
You really should get married.
Honestly, hop into 6 months, man. Like JD said on Twitter, JD, oh gosh, what's his last name?
Flynn,
yeah, I always forget his last name. JD Salinger? Flynn said on Twitter, JD Salinger, author of Catcher in the Rye and others. like JD Salinger said on Twitter, just get married, have your reception in the church hall, do a buffet, don't freak out, just have a party, and then, you know, go be married. It's actually really great.
Is that not exactly what me and Emma did? Did J.D. Flynn, was he at our wedding? Is that how he
That's how we
found
knew.
Out about that? Yeah.
Phoebe was like, we probably should have. She went into the church hall at Ascension. She's like, actually, it's kind of nice in here. We probably should have just had our reception in here. And I was like, you should have said that thousands of dollars ago.
Yeah.
Oh, we got a good deal on our reception. It's fine.
Your reception was great. The reason they got a good deal is because there was no air conditioning at their reception.
Yeah, but it was like the best day to not have air
conditioning. It was great, but I was dancing and I was so sweaty.
Ethan, that would have been you with air conditioning.
I know, but I'm just saying.
You were sweaty at your wedding.
I just remember being there and being like, ooh, I'm in the South. Ooh.
Ooh, baby, it's sweaty.
Having a good time.
Having a good time.
But it was great. It was a ton of fun. I loved your wedding.
One more update from the Rosh and Prisha.
Oh, thank goodness.
Thank goodness. As deemed by Father Harrison, the best Dr. Ethan's dating corner ever.
Ever.
Even including Eliezer, apparently.
I know.
Nurse Ethan and Dr. Patrick, many updates, but first, thank you for validating us and a recognition of the red flags. Apparently, there's a red flag emoji meme on Twitter now.
Oh, really?
So, yeah. I posted about it on on our crunch Twitter today. Prisha does not realize the red flags, but she does now realize that she is dating Rosh. Wait, what? Prisha does not realize the red flags, but she does now realize. Oh, that's right. She didn't realize
she didn't realize that they were dating. Yeah,
that's funny. So Rosh moves around our state because of his job, but right now he's moving to our city for a month. Secondly, they are officially dating and both recognize it, but everyone in the friend group is still against it. A few of us have told Prisha why. We told her about the emotional manipulation, but she doesn't get it. She fully believes Rosh wants her good, but we don't see that. The friends don't, because he says things that aren't oriented towards virtue. They're still hanging out with Prisha, but she's still with. So the sad ending on that one. She's still with the boy. But, dang, you know, it's okay. Send one up for Prisha. Pray that she makes good decisions, because we want everyone to make good decisions.
The good news is that if this guy screwed up before and he hasn't repented and changed, then he's going to screw up again and she's going to learn. Like, it's just going to happen.
That's true. People do be learning.
People do be learning. And guys like this, they tend to make similar mistakes over and over again.
Over and over and over, yeah.
One day they're going to be hanging out. He's going to pull out his vape pen and she'll be like, oh my gosh, oh, I didn't know you were this kind of guy.
Mango flavored? That's disgusting. No,
at least have the dignity to pick cool mint if you're going to pick anything. Ridiculous. All right. Ethan really has to pee. And we're going to sign off this podcast. Patreon.com/TheCrunch, Facebook.com/groups/TheCrunchCast. Patrick, do you have anything else for the people?
Use the discount code TheCrunch on NewPolity.com to get me into New Polity. All right, everyone. Have a good time.
Thank you all for listening. Please pray for us. We will be praying for you, and we will see you all next week.